There are some genetic loadings for learning disabilities. So the kids can be born with some vulnerability, and when the environment is not really designed to compensate for this vulnerability, then it can be getting worse over time.
83% of Americans identify as not very happy, which can hold you back and negatively affect your relationships and your business. On this podcast, we discuss the proven steps to happiness so you can restore balance and rekindle your joy.
Welcome to another edition of How to Be Happier for Entrepreneurs. As always, I'm super excited, super pumped to talk about this material. And today we have Natasha that is just going to blow your mind. Her expertise is pretty impressive. So Natasha, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Happy to be here.
And you told me you were coming from sunny where? Where's the sun shining?
I am in San Francisco, and we have a bright, sunny day today.
Awesome. So in light of the selection of the word of the year in 2023, it was authentic. I love that word. How do you see the role of authenticity in achieving happiness and self-fulfillment?
Well, I don't know how this word became so popular. It is possible that people were looking it up because of fake things, because the opposite of authentic is fake, right? And with AI, there are a lot of fakes these days. But it definitely caught my attention because Authentic Happiness is the book by Martin Seligman, who is the father of positive psychology. So he put together a group of people, experts in the field, at the end of the 20th century. And what was born out of it is positive psychology, which is the science of happiness and thriving.
Love it.
And when they asked this question, so what makes us happy, right? Before that, the belief was if people don't have depression or anxiety, they are happy. But it's not the case. We can languish. We can just feel, right? Not happy. So when the question was asked and the group of people answered it, the first core premise of being happy is being authentically self. You cannot be happy pretending to be something you are not. So that's why this word definitely caught my attention. Authentic happiness is what I hope all of us can tap into. And the opposite of it, we talk now about toxic positivity, when people kind of fake being happy, but you see that not.
Yeah. How are you? My response is I'm awesome and I am awesome. I'm in the state of feeling awesome, right? So authenticity, why do so many people lack authenticity?
Well, I think it's not an easy answer, but because it takes us a long time to be ourselves, right? So for me, everything is filtered through my knowledge of the brain. So the question is, do you, Brad, know how long it takes our brain to mature?
I think 25 years.
About. And does it stop developing after that?
I hope not.
No. If we do things right. So this is the field of neuroscience that we all talk about, neuroplasticity. But what is interesting, when we are very young, neuroplasticity is amazing and enormous. Between 1 and 5 to 7, there is this huge work going on under the hood of our brain. Between 1 and 5 years of age, there are between 1 and 2 million neural connections that are formed in the brain of a child each second of life.
Wow.
Just ponder, 1 second.
Wow.
About 2 neural connections. And whether these connections are made to the parts of the brain that will support authenticity and feeling secure, feeling safe to be yourself, or these are the connections that are made to danger, defense system. This is amygdala vis-a-vis prefrontal cortex. That matters. So prefrontal cortex, or frontal lobes, are considered to be the real estate. I did as a parent, I'm sure you did.
Oh,
so
yeah.
In retrospect, we can relate to it. But I think it is a little bit easier these days to be parents because we have a lot of answers to the questions that were difficult to answer before. So my son is about to turn 47 and I still continue like parenting and reparenting him, looking at my mistakes. So the question is, why don't we become ourselves? Well, because we a lot of times as parents pass down the next generation our like trauma. Yeah. Our brains behave badly. So in parenting, we have to reparent ourselves to become better parents. Easier said than done.
Yeah. So I met you through the Gabor Mate book, The Myth of Normal, and I know you're friends with him. He talks a lot about authenticity and attachment. Are you in that camp where we have to give up authenticity as a child to keep the attachment with our parents because it's like a survival thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You cannot survive without your parents. So as you said, it takes about 25 years for our brain to mature. You cannot really make adult decisions as a child. So in our culture, probably it's about 18 when you can like live more or less independently. So when there is this conflict between the need to belong so that you survive and the need to be yourself, it's a no-brainer, so to speak, because it's not a logical decision. It's the intuitive decision a child would make.
So if you lack authenticity, you lack true connection with yourself, and you're not your happiest self. So on the flip side of that, what does someone do? How do you help people find that authenticity and that connection with themselves?
Well, we start from understanding what makes us unhappy. So one of the things that in this culture we don't like is difficult feelings. We like feeling good, right? So, and we all want the easy button. If we're unhappy, and a lot of us are real unhappy these days, as a therapist, I've been working close to 30 years. I've never received as many requests for therapy as I'm receiving now.
Wow.
Gabor and I talked about it. We are living through the time of collective trauma. Things are not good for people these days. So there are a lot of things that happen that are unsettling. So what happens, we respond to things because our brain is designed to tune into other people's feelings. We can catch feelings. And then we don't know what to do with them. And then we go to a doctor and they prescribe medications. And I'm not opposed to medications sometimes. Antidepressants are very helpful. But a lot of times what is missing in this process of just killing the messenger is the message. Why am I stuck? So I see depression and anxiety as the brain's response to being stuck in one way or another. Anxiety and depression go hand in hand. 80% of people who have depression will have anxiety.
Wow.
And anxiety is the hyperarousal in your nervous system. And what comes up will go down. And then depression is hyperarousal. So what we do in therapy, instead of killing the messenger, we are asking questions, and I call it C++ language. We learn C++ language, which is compassionate curiosity investigation. I'm wondering, what's missing? What is the message? Where am I stuck? What's not going in the way that my heart desires? We ask smart questions. And then, you know, one of the one-liners that my clients hear from me early on, I'm not the guru, you're the guru, but we can develop a relationship where one and one is three, the third entity is us, and we together can figure out how to get unstuck in the area of stuckness.
Yeah, absolutely love it. One of the things I've learned in studying memory reconsolidation is that depression, anxiety, or anything, alcoholism, just put anything in there. It's your brain's way of trying to protect you from something that it thinks is worse. But oftentimes that thing that your brain thinks is worse is just a false meaning that you placed on something years and years ago. That to me is just like amazing. So when people are like, oh, you have a disorder, something's wrong with you. No, nothing's wrong with you. Your brain is doing exactly what it should be doing. It's trying to keep you from feeling more pain by having these quote symptoms of depression, anxiety, OCD, addiction, whatever it is. So true.
And this is like Gabor Mate has this movie made on his work. And the name of the movie is The Wisdom of Trauma. And he talks exactly about adaptations that were adaptive until they stop being adaptive. They become maladaptive. And that's what a lot of times people, can change the trajectory of their lives.
So tell us more about your one-liner, what happens in childhood doesn't stay in childhood, and what's its kind of implications on our quest for authenticity?
Yeah. So you heard me talking about how there is this enormous neuroplasticity in the brain of a child, right? So in a way, it works the same way as when we are hypnotized. You and I studied hypnosis, so you know it's kind of a different reality. So Mike Yapko, who I learned from, defined hypnosis as believed in imagination. Believed in imagination. We imagine things to be true, and then they become our self-fulfilling prophecy. So what happens in childhood a lot of times creates the trajectory for our lives, because the foundation of our brain is developed. And because frontal lobes that are enormously important for cognitive functioning, integration of the emotional and cognitive response flexibility, a lot of times what happens if your childhood experiences were traumatic, it creates the neurobiology, and your neurobiology was created by your biography. And then this neurobiology creates the trajectory of your life. Mm. So what happens in childhood doesn't stay in childhood was born when I was watching TV, but there is this commercial about Vegas. What happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas either, but the commercial is what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And I was like, I don't know, but childhood for sure. What happens in childhood creates our nervous system, our brain, that later, as you talked about, sometimes when people have traumatic experiences, they have to cope by developing bad mind habits, which is a lot of times resorting to either drugs or alcohol. But it makes sense at the time they struggle. So adverse childhood experiences study that was published looked at over 7,000 people, middle-class families, and discovered that when we have a lot of adverse childhood experiences, which is neglect, abuse, when one of the parents is incarcerated, addictions in the family, so there's the list of 10. When we have four or more, it affects our emotional functioning, cognitive functioning, learning disabilities are more likely to be a part of it. So that's what I discovered when I started going to San Quentin here in close to San Francisco, Death Row, to see how childhood experiences affect people's lives. And that's why I say what happens in childhood doesn't stay in childhood. So in a way, we have to work with the brain that was developed and then change it. San Quentin is definitely the horrible outcome of adverse childhood experiences. But I also work with extremely successful, high-functioning people who have the brain.
Mm-hmm. So the ACE study, do you know how that study came about?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Vincent Felitti, who was this brilliant physician, was working with people who tried to lose weight and they would succeed and then drop out and regain weight. So he had his aha moment and recruited CDC to conduct this amazing study. To me, it was like when pieces of the puzzle came together. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Like women were losing weight, but they were dropping out of his program. And he's like, why is this? So I look at all the folks who struggle with weight loss. It's not their fault. They think that, oh, they're just not eating right or exercising right. But you can go through I've seen it. Like I've got a friend who is a weight loss and he's as good as they come. But I've seen people go through his program and they put back on the weight. It's nothing he's doing wrong, but it's because they've got these underlying things. So it's just fascinating. So on that topic, tell me if I'm right. I've read Scattered Minds. Gabor Mate believes that most ADD is from the environment of childhood. Am I saying that correctly?
I have read this book and I talked to Gabor about it. He believes that he has ADD. He was diagnosed as an adult. And to me, the jury's out whether there is genetic loading for ADHD. I definitely see the familial patterns. So I think that a lot of times it's the combination of genetic loading, but also a lot of times trauma. So what ADHD is, the weakness in the part of the brain that we kind of touched upon, frontal lobes. Before the term ADHD was coined, it was called minimal brain dysfunction. And because of what I've said, what happens in childhood doesn't stay in childhood. There's definitely the link between trauma and inattention. Because think about it. If you don't feel safe as a child, does it make sense for you to focus and concentrate?
No, it doesn't.
So, and you know, my pet peeve is I have a lot of educated parents who come to see me for, you know, either individual counseling or sometimes parenting counseling. And they are 5 or 6 year olds in school. And they're, you know, acting out maybe, or they're like inattentive or hyper aroused. And the suggestion that is made by the school system, put them on stimulants. And I'm screaming bloody murder because there are more than 4 million American kids now on stimulants. Mm. And the brain is not designed for the child to sit still. The schools were designed for people like myself who always was like had the capacity. I'm pretty lazy, so I never really had to work very hard, but my attention and focus was always very good. So I always graduated on top of my class because it was easy for me. But my brother wasn't that way. He had a different brain. It was difficult, and he probably had a little bit of ADHD. So in one family, kids can be very different. And when we label kids as like problematic, when we put them on Ritalin or Adderall or other stimulants, then they don't have the opportunity to compensate for whatever the weakness is there.
So did I understand you right, saying that you and Gabor say that, yes, ADD likely has a lot to do with the environment as a child, but that you're not ruling out the fact that there could be some type of brain disorder, malfunction? I don't know what the right word is.
Yes, some brain vulnerability that is genetic. There is this saying in genetics, genetics loads the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger, right? So it's epigenetics, the new field in medicine. So not all genes will be expressed. But I do think that there are some genetic loadings for learning disabilities. So the kids can be born with some vulnerability, and then when the environment is not really designed to compensate for this vulnerability, then it can be getting worse over time.
So if I heard you comment correctly, you've seen a familial pattern in ADD. So you've seen the parents and the kids. I think, in my opinion, alcoholism doesn't run in families. The associated trauma from the alcoholic is what runs in families. Could that be the same for ADD, that the kid has ADD because the parent had ADD and they have ADD because of their tough childhood?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mind blowing. It's so amazing.
It is.
So you mentioned death row. You spent time working there, not on death row. you spent time working there. Tell us what that was like. I mean, that must have been a fascinating, interesting. What was it like, and what did you learn about criminal minds that are the same as most human beings?
It was definitely a very profoundly helpful experience for me. When I was first hired to assist someone with death penalty appeal, I was conflicted. I think I had the mindset, like the majority of people do, that there are good eggs like myself. I am a law-abiding citizen who came from another country and helping people, working at UCSF. And I'm a good egg, right? And then there is a person who I was asked to evaluate, who killed the mother of 2 children when he was 18, and now he's appealing his death sentence. So his defense attorney asked me to go, and to me, it was really mind-blowing in itself, because I come from Russia, and in Russia, if the government thinks you are guilty, you are guilty. So here I was like curious, they want me to assist this person. So that was my motivation. I also was curious about the criminal mind. I was watching Law and Order, and it's very simple there, right? Bad guys and good guys, and good guys, which I was a good guy, catch bad guys. So now there was a little bit of confusion. But it was absolutely an important experience that revolutionized my understanding of good and evil. And that's where I learned many things. One is what happens in childhood doesn't stay in childhood. I interviewed now over 80 people on death row, and that's the same story over and over again. The second thing I learned how to...
Can you tell us what that story is?
The story is adverse childhood experiences affected the trajectory of people's lives. So if you remember from ACE study, 4 or more is the alarming predictor of your physical health, mental health, and neurological. A lot of times learning disabilities are linked to it. But some of my clients had 10.
Wow.
9, I think, is the lowest number.
When you say your clients, the inmate clients or clients in general?
The inmate clients.
Okay.
People who I met on death row.
So everyone understands, if 10 is the worst possible childhood you could have ever had from a trauma standpoint.
Yes. And at some point in time, after I've done dozens of these cases, I felt like, well, nothing will surprise me anymore. Because the first time I started hearing these stories, my heart was breaking over and over again. And then I felt like, okay, it's the same story. And then I would meet someone who has even more tragic story and my heart will break again. So it was really interesting. So one is that's what taught me a lesson in the neurobiology of trauma and how it affects our brain and our ability to make good decisions. The second thing that it taught me is deep compassion. I stopped thinking that I'm somehow like better than other people on death row. I realized, no, I'm made of the same fabric. It's just I won the lottery by being born to people who knew how to parent. They were not perfect, but I absolutely felt loved. I felt safe. These are our irreducible needs, right? When you don't feel loved, when you don't feel safe, when you don't have clear boundaries, there will be the price you pay in terms of the brain development.
Wow, that was really, yeah. Gabor says, you know, pretty much your story is, everyone's story is unmet childhood needs, right? Do you think that there is a prisoner in the United States who had all their childhood needs met?
I haven't met it. Him or her yet. So mostly it's him. I met 2 women on death row. The majority of my clients are men. Haven't met yet the person whose childhood was good. But even if we look outside of death row, like a lot of times people say to me, my childhood was wonderful. And then I'm really suspicious because all of us get traumatized in one way or another. It's just when you have 10, you know, then, and if you have the propensity for acting out, expressing anger in a way that is destructive, then you may end up in the criminal justice system. But there are other adaptations to trauma, yeah. Addictions, definitely. So what happens in childhood affects how we adapt. And a lot of times, people who are not in the criminal justice system, who have history of depression, anxiety, and live lives that they don't want to live, end up in my office when on the surface, they're very high functioning.
Yeah, really interesting. So I know you do a lot of parenting coaching.
True.
You emphasize that perfection in parenting is unattainable. What are some key strategies or principles that you coach parents to adopt for raising emotionally healthy children that will thrive and get into good relationships?
Yeah. So the most important thing, I think, is seeing parenting as the opportunity to reparent yourself. Children will challenge you. And when we are under stress, a lot of times our ancient brains will behave badly. So I always talk to parents as this is the opportunity for you to learn how to parent from the inside out. Take care of the person inside of you who feels now vulnerable, who is making you like act out in a way of yelling or shaming or blaming your child. This is something that is definitely impossible to not like lose composure. So all my mothers who want to be perfect, I help a lot of parents when their children are very young, discover very soon that, you know, how all of us say, oh, I will never act like my parents, right? When we grow up, and then we discover, oh my God, I am my mother, right? All of us. So just being forgiving and knowing I'm doing the best that I can, and I can do better if I am compassionate to myself. So there is no such thing as perfect parenting, but you can be a present parent. The studies have shown that the neural connections that are formed as a result of early attachments are later repurposed for love life. So we are teaching our children now what they will need later. So that means that in any relationship with a child, there is harmony. When we are having fun, then there is disharmony. How we repair disharmony matters. So that's what my parenting coaching is. Okay, so let's learn from the mistake you made if you feel like it wasn't a good connection. Children are resilient. You need to have like 30% of practices that are considered to be safe, secure attachment to create a healthy child. So 30%, it is doable, right? Not 100%.
So tell me more when you say your kids are an opportunity to reparent yourself. What is it about the kid and not your neighbor or your husband or your wife?
Yeah, so this is something that I created for myself when I was parenting Andrew. Andrew is my soon-to-be 47-year-old son. And I remember when I was like losing my composure and I was studying psychology, child psychology, neuropsychology when I became a mom. I was 22. So I thought it was just so well-equipped. And then all of a sudden, I wasn't very well equipped when he was about 3 and he started pushing back and setting limits. And I remember I labeled him as my spiritual teacher because I was becoming my mom who was not very gentle, who was a very like domineering woman. So I had to learn how to stop myself and understand when my brain was behaving badly. I wasn't as smart back then as I am now, so I continue kind of changing the way I talk to him sometimes, and I joke when I push his button. I'm like, oh, Andrew, I'm sorry I pushed your button. And the reason I know is because guess who installed it in you? So now we can joke. Now we can have adult conversations. But they are our spiritual teachers. So if we blame them and we want them to be responsible for our feelings, so parenting from the inside out means taking responsibility. Responsibility. You have the ability to change your response from maladaptive to adaptive.
I'm doing the math in my head. Your son's 47 and you had him when you're 22. And I got to tell you, you look closer to your son's age than your age. So whatever you're doing, keep it up. It's the happiness. It's the happiness.
You know, it is true. I am a health psychologist, right? So I teach at the medical school, University of California at San Francisco. And I started working there and teaching in 93, so 30 years. And in health psychology, this is something that we know. When you are happy, you are more likely to be youthful and to be healthy. When people come to see me in therapy, this is my promise. I will help you to be happier, and by the virtue of being happier, you will always be healthier.
Oh, I love it.
Because this is mind-body medicine that we now embrace. It's not like different. Your mind and your body are connected. And when you work on your heart and your soul, you also can improve your physical health, not just mental health.
And you'll likely be more prosperous and make more money, because most people think money brings you happiness. It's just the opposite. They've done studies that find that happier people make more money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is one of my favorite experts in positive psychology is Sean Acor, who has a very good TED Talk. And he wrote the book, Happiness Advantage. And the jury is in. Absolutely. When we are happy, we are more likely to be successful in any area where we put our attention to. For some people, it's being prosperous. For other people, it's being youthful and healthy. And for other people, it's having thriving relationships. For me, it's all three. So, yeah, but when you are happy, you're more likely.
Yeah, So back to the parenting, when you work with parents and they're just like, my kids are driving me insane, what does that really mean?
Well, that means that you haven't found the way of negotiating agreements with them yet. And they are supposed to drive us insane because their brains are not yet developed. They don't have the brakes. As we pointed out, it takes about 25 years for the part of the brain that is the most important, we call it the organ of civilization, frontal lobes, is the last to develop. That's where the brakes are. That's where compassion and empathy is. So, you know, kids, when they're very young, they don't have capacity for empathy and compassion yet. They're very egocentric. So it's not their job to please us. So when our kids are driving us crazy, which they do, we go, I'm wondering what I should be doing differently. And when you teach people like strategies, effective strategies, when you teach them not to use strategies that were used with them, it works. It works. So the first step is changing the mindset from it's my child's job to make me happy to no, it's my responsibility to teach my child age-appropriate practices of handling adult relationships.
So if your kid triggers you, gets you really mad, is it really your kid or is it the way you're thinking or the meanings that you're placing on things from past experiences?
It's both. It's both. Kids do push our buttons. We want them to think about how, I remember when my son was little, there were a lot of fights over, I made pancakes, right? These are too big. I'm not going to eat them. And what you hear when he says that, what a bratty child, right? He is like 5 years old and I have a job and patience and husband and life is hard, right? So immediately you hear this voice, a bratty child. And of course he is, but he's supposed to be bratty because children are egocentric. So if you catch yourself and disengage from this escalation, right, you can always disarm them. So it's just the tricks that sometimes it's hard for a parent to think on their feet. So that's why we, in parenting coaching, we rehearse strategies and then we recycle them. But basically, it's talking to a child in the language they understand. So small children are right-brainers, and the right brain is like emotional, and everything happens in here and now and very quickly, right? And we try logic with them, and they're not logical yet. So we need to really master the tone of voice, how we talk to them, you know, get on their eye level. So there are all kinds of little tricks that I teach all my parenting coaching clients to use, and it works.
Beautiful. So if someone is having parenting issues or other type of issues, how can they find you? Where can they work with you?
So I have a website, which is my name, natashakazanov.com. And Kazanov is spelled with K-H-A-Z-A-N-O-V. And there are some good videos that are free. There are videos about parenting, how to raise resilient children with the brain and mind, 8 secrets of raising resilient children. There are some of the talks that I gave. So there is some good information there.
Yeah, that's an understatement. Her website is freaking packed with, I mean, she's got a page with, I don't know how many videos on there, 20 or 30 that are just amazing videos. So great job. What do you spend most of your time doing now, Natasha?
Well, I still see clients, but now I just formed a startup that will help people develop better relationships with themselves first and then other people. The happiness study is multiple now, but my favorite is the Harvard happiness study. Looked at what makes us happy. This is the longitudinal study that lasted over 80 years, still going on. Yep. And, you know, the most important finding in the study, to me, is pretty trivial. I was disappointed. It's pretty trivial, actually. The finding in the study is the quality of our relationships with other people that determine how successful and happy we are. But our relationships with other people are determined by the way we relate to ourselves. So this is what is challenging, right? We have different parts of ourselves. the parts that are helpful and the parts that are not very helpful. So in order to have good relationships with other people, you need really to repair yourself in a way of integrating back to authenticity, to be your authentic self. And one of the one-liners that I like, you cannot always be right, but you can always be kind.
Mm.
To yourself first, and then to other people. So self-compassion is my secret sauce. So I teach people in this new startup that I am now pouring a lot of energy into. I teach couples how to get along so that when they have children, they won't have like battles between them, who's right and who is wrong, triangulating children. And this is like love without fear. So the last thing I'm going to say, Gabor and I had lunch at my house right before his book was published. And we were talking about how we are aging and how quick everything went. And then somehow we started talking about what we want on our tombstones. He said, "Well, I have like my epitaph chosen already." And like, "Okay, do tell." And he says, "It was harder than I thought." And I laughed and I said, "Well, if it is hard for you, what about other people?" And then I thought and I said, and my epitaph should read, "She finally learned how to love without fear."
Mm.
And I said to him, "And you know what? When you learn how to love without fear, it stops being so hard. Because then you can have compassion from the inside out."
Mm. Remove fear and judgment. And if you're in a crappy relationship and you're blaming the other person, the problem in relationships is always the relationship that you have with yourself. If you want to fix your relationship with your partner or spouse, fix the relationship you have with yourself. Natasha, thank you so much. That was as amazing, maybe even more than I thought. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for having me, Brad.
And please, I'm trying to reach 1 million people. So if you're listening to this and you like the content, can you please help me reach more people so that we can end suffering and give people freedom and happiness that they deserve by rating the show, giving it a nice review, sharing it, whatever you can do to help spread this message, I'd really appreciate it. And that concludes another episode of How to Be Happier. And remember, love heals all.
Hit subscribe if you don't want to miss out on more life-changing content. And if you're struggling, you don't have to. Go to bradchandler.com/contact. There, you can join the Facebook community of like-minded entrepreneurs, and you'll see a button to schedule your freedom and happiness call. See you on the next episode.